This is episode number 23 with Cecilia Pagkalinawan. Welcome to the Rise Higher podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Kwong, and each week I'll bring you an inspiring guest with an empowering message to help you rise higher and live your best life. Each guest shares their time of struggle and setback and what specific mindsets, tools, practices, or habits they use to overcome so that you can apply them to your life. This show is to remind you that you're not alone and that there's always a pathway up. Thanks for spending some time with me today. I'm grateful to be on this journey with you. Our struggles are a call for us to rise. So here we go. Let's dive deep now so we can rise higher together. Welcome back to the Rise Higher podcast. You guys, I am really excited for you to hear today's guest, who's my friend, Cecilia Pagkalinawan, who is a badass serial entrepreneur. And she was named one of Silicon Alley's top 100 internet executives by the Silicon Alley Reporter. She was also named New York Woman of the Entrepreneur of the Year by Naobo, and she received Burberry's Rising Star Award, and she was named by Inc. magazine as one of New York City's top four content marketers and a supermarketer. So today's episode is very raw, and it's a very honest conversation where Cecilia opens up about losing her sister Teresa to an opioid overdose. So Cecilia shares how the devastating news of her sister dying impacted her and hit her to her very core, and how the loss of her sister affected every inch of her life. And it actually came at a time when Cecilia's career was at an all-time high. And she shares what happened after as her life came crashing down. And so Cecilia shares how she fell into a depression and how she had to stay strong to keep it all together for her high-profile business, and also how she struggled with the grief as her business started to fall apart because of the dot-com crash. You know, it's really interesting because death is actually, it's something that I've come to peace with for myself, but I haven't been able to fully come to peace with losing the people that I love. And I've fortunately not lost anybody that I've been, you know, that I'm extremely close with. And I can't even imagine what that pain will be like when I lose someone that I deeply love. And so in this episode, you know, Cecilia shares the process that she went through to heal through the devastation one day at a time, and to do it in a natural way since she'd seen her sister abuse and pass from prescription medications. So on today's podcast, some of the things that we chat about are how Cecilia dealt with the guilt of losing her sister to an opioid overdose, how Cecilia had to shut down her successful high-profile business and take care of herself, and the importance of taking the time to fully grieve and the role a grief therapist plays for those experiencing great loss and heartache. And you're going to hear what Cecilia did to immediately alleviate the grief she was experiencing and the practices, tools, and habits that got serotonin flowing. We'll also talk about why daily cardio is important to activate our feel-good hormones, especially during times of hardship and grief. And you'll also find out what all-natural remedies and supplements Cecilia turned to during her grieving process. And you'll hear how one small miracle shortly after 9/11 changed Cecilia's life forever. And of course, so much more. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Cecilia. And for everything that we mention in today's episode and for links to connect with her, you can check it out in the show notes. And that's over at stephaniekwong.com/EP23. Okay, let's drop in with Cecilia. Cecilia!
Hi, Steph. How are you?
I'm so good, and I'm so excited that you are on the Rise Higher podcast. For all of you guys listening, to give you a little backstory, we're both members of this amazing clubhouse called Habitas, and there's a New York location and a Venice location.
And we are all in a WhatsApp group. And I knew I was coming out to New York City. I put in the group, I was like, hey guys, our New York City members, I'm coming out there. I have a podcast. This is the premise of it. Anybody that you think I should have on the show? And Cecilia was like the one person who wrote back and said, I have some people for you. So we messaged, I messaged you. I didn't hear back, which is totally fine. But the day I arrived at Habitas, she's the very first person I met, which synchronicities I love. The divine is so good. And
I gave you such a warm welcome. We're old friends. Yes. Because you have this energy about you that's just so like friendly and open. And I just wanted to give you a hug and make you feel at home.
Thanks. And that is exactly how I felt, thanks to you. So that was probably, you're the perfect person I could have walked in to first greet. And I'm really grateful to get to know you more, and we'll continue to get to know you. But when Cecilia and I were sitting here, we're actually in the same room where we met right now. But she was asking more about the show. And as I was sharing, she started sharing her story. And every time Cecilia was talking, I'm like, wait. Okay, I just got to have you on my show, because this woman is such a powerhouse, not only in what she's created in her career, but in her personal life as a mother, and even, you know, in her own healing. So, Cecilia, I'd love for you just to kind of share a bit about what we were talking about the other day and share your story. You know what I'm talking about, but just to share.
Well, what's always interesting for me is, especially with the whole social media oversharing of things, mm-hmm. is I'm always conscious about what is behind the story that people are posting. In fact, for some reason, when I'm on social media, I can kind of detect when my friends actually, in spite of posting things that are positive, that something is wrong. And I call them, mm-hmm. and I reach out to them. And I'm also one of those, like, I over say happy birthday to everyone. I want to say happy birthday to everyone. So I think that came about because a very young age, I lost my sister at age 33. And in the back of my mind, I always feel like I could have done more. I didn't do enough to be there for her. So I feel like in general, like with people out there, you know, even with me giving you a warm welcome, despite your positive vibes, maybe you had a bad day that day and you needed that warm welcome, you know? Mm-hmm. So I feel like every day that we can all contribute to anybody's lives, a stranger or somebody we know, in a positive way.
Oh my gosh. You're so magical. Well, I love you. And yeah, I think just hearing you saying that, you know, I think our tragedies or our challenges do give us powerful lessons to learn about who we are or how we want to be in the world. And although, you know, your sister's, it's so tragic, and I would love for you to open up about that. But that's created you to be this open person. And that meant a lot to me when I came in here, because when I walked downstairs, you know, people were sitting at the dining table. They just kind of looked at me. There was someone sitting out in the outdoor area, and I said hello. And it's actually someone I knew, because I know him from the Venice location. He was a little bit cold, quite honestly. And I was surprised by that. And so that's why I was just searching. And then when I came upstairs, there you were on the couch, and you were so warm. And that actually really had me go like, oh, cool, not all New Yorkers are closed off. And I know they're not, because I come to New York City and I have a lot of amazing friends here. But that was the feeling, because sometimes, you know, everybody, I think, wants to feel welcomed and wants to belong. And so often how our society is, it doesn't always create that. So the fact that you are choosing to be a catalyst for people to feel like they belong, to know that they matter, they're seen because of your warmness, is huge.
Well, I wasn't always this way. I did my first startup in my 20s, and it was venture-backed, and I grew it to 26 employees. It was a e-commerce consulting firm called Boutique Y3K, and in 1998, my first client was Nine West. So 1998, launching an e-commerce site for shoes was the kind that you get questions from the board members with, such as, will women actually
buy shoes without trying them on? Mm-hmm. And will people actually put credit card information online? I mean, it was kind of crazy. But so we launched Nine West Shoe Store online 2 years before Zappos even launched, you know. And
you were trailblazing.
And the company was bootstrapped for 2 years until I got my first venture capital investment of $5 million. And I think I was told I was the first East Coast tech company, like, or I'm not sure if it's East Coast tech company in general, but to receive West Coast VC investment. Because at that time, New York wasn't being taken too seriously as a tech center by Silicon Valley investors. So I was really fortunate to get venture capital investment from Vantage Point Venture Partners. And it allowed me to, it was a crazy time. It was very busy. The rise was quick because all of a sudden I was in Wall Street Journal. I was in the cover of Asia Week. I was in Fortune magazine. I was in Vogue even. I was named one of the 13 girls who rule New York along with all these socialites, mm-hmm. like the Hiltons. It was kind of crazy.
Whoa,
it
awesome.
Felt so out of place. It felt so out of place. Well, I was in this photo that Gotham did. I was sitting at a cocktail table next to Nikki Hilton, and she was only 17. And I'm like, I don't really feel that proud about being one of the 13 girls who rule New York when she's only 17 and she's already on that list. And I had to become a CEO and raise venture capital funding to even have the right to sit here next to her and be recognized by this magazine. Hers was just like by birth.
By birth, yeah. Yours was by blood, sweat, and tears, and yeah.
So that's kind of New York for you, though. Like, you know, you have the ability to be here and make it, and alongside the people who are third generation, you know, by birth heiresses, and you have the ability to socialize with them or not socialize with them and do your own thing. So during that time, you know, when you get a lot of press, people inundate you with attention. You get invited to all sorts of events and things, which was all good. And I felt that it got a bit too much, you know, and I do realize that I barely had time for the people who are really important to me, which is my family and friends and close friends. And I mean, I had to travel to conferences. I was invited to speak at Columbia, Harvard, MIT. I was some conferences in Las Vegas and things like that. I was invited to speak in Hong Kong, in Manila. It was a crazy time, you know, to be this first generation immigrant woman who was brought to the United States with her four siblings by parents when I was 8 years old. So it was, part of it was, you know, I kept on pinching myself. When you talk about like imposter syndrome, it was definitely happening at that time. And I received this award from the National Association of Women Business Owners as the Woman Business Owner of the Year in New York City. And the award was given to me by Hillary Clinton. And it was also given to me by Lloyd and Nicholas Lewis, who a famous Filipina woman who married Reginald Lewis. And when he suddenly died of a brain tumor in his 50s, she took over the company and sold it for over $1 billion. And so it was kind of like this amazing time. And so I was on top of the world. And so one weekend, a friend of mine who was dating at the time, Ital Shore, who actually wrote the song Smooth and won a Grammy for it.
Oh, nice.
He invited me to go to weekend in Woodstock. And I think it was supposed to be with Liv Tyler and her boyfriend at the time. They have a house in Woodstock. And in the car, guess who was in the car? Was Scum Frog, who was at that time was called Jesse. Well, he went by the name The Dutch. That was his DJ name.
Nice.
And he was married to someone else. So we were in my convertible Volkswagen driving up to Woodstock, singing, I remember, like Aretha Franklin songs at the top of our lungs with a top down. And this was October, the trees were changing.
Oh, perfection.
And then I get this phone call. Like, it was my sister's caller ID. It said her name, Teresa. And so I picked it up. I said, hey, what's up? And it wasn't her on the phone. It was her husband. He says, Cecilia, where are you? I said, I'm out of town. I'm driving. He goes, can you pull over? And that's when I knew something was wrong. Because one, her husband never ever calls me. He was using her phone and he asked me to pull over. So I pulled over and he said, Teresa's gone. I said, what do you mean she's gone? He said, she's dead. I said, what do you mean she's dead? What happened? He said, I found her in the bathroom, overdosed. And I said, what? What time? He said, it was like 2 a.m. I said, where were you? He said, I was out at a DJing gig. He was a DJ. I was like, why was she doing home alone? I mean, I had all these questions. And I was in disbelief because this was October. They just got married in August. You know, when your sister marries someone, you think that they have their lives ahead of them, not like their lives ending. And the odd thing is the night before this road trip that I was doing to Woodstock, I was home alone doing nothing. And usually when I'm alone doing nothing ever in my entire life, my sister was always there. And even when she moved to New York, when I moved to New York, whether we lived in, and she lived in Brooklyn, I lived in Manhattan, I would always call and say, hey, what are you doing tonight? And we'll come up with something. So that night this happened, I was just home because I knew I had this amazing weekend that was ahead of me. And I was just by myself and I could have reached out to her and done something with her, but I did not know he wasn't spending it with her. You know what I mean? You just somehow believe that their husband or significant other will be there to take care of them. It's no longer me that would be that person. So I said to my friends, I said, my sister just died. I have to go back. And I said, I didn't want to ruin their weekend. So I said, let me drive you to the house and I will come back. And they said, no, we can't let you drive by yourself. And Jesse's Comfrey actually said, let me take over the wheel. You go sit in the back and I'll drive you. Just tell me where to go. And from the car, I had to tell my brothers to meet up. I had to call my brothers to tell them what happened. I had to tell my brother to have my parents come over his house, that we all needed to come together, and I had to tell them. I didn't want them to tell our parents on the phone. I wanted all of us to be there. I have three brothers. And so, yeah, so I was bawling in the back of this car. I couldn't just, you know, to come from like feeling you're on top of the world, you have the world at your feet, you have your life ahead of you, and all of a sudden the bottom was pulled out from under me. My sister and I, you know, shared our bedrooms all our lives. We were very close. And when she moved to New York, when I was still in college, I would visit the city and I would stay with her. So she was the one, when I was a workaholic, she always called me a workaholic. She would insist that I would go out. Let's go out dancing. Let's go out for listen to music. Oh, my friend's playing here. Let's go. You know, she was the one that made sure that I had a social life, that I actually did fun things and not just worked all the time. Yeah. So it just so happened that my friend Ital, again, this amazing guy who's a very talented musician, he just won a Grammy Award a year or two ago. His brother had shot himself, who was also a musician in LA. And I said, Ital, how did you survive? How do you do this? How do you do it? You know, while I'm bawling on his lap, the back of the car. And he said, you just continue day by day, Cecilia. You just do what you need to do and get up every day. And he said, I found the time where I felt like I was semi-normal, where the new normal is having your best friend or your sibling be gone. He said, it's at 7 years. So he goes, so in 7 years, we'll be okay. So I actually, when I have friends who lose loved ones, I tell them, it's going to be tough. You're going to need a lot of help. You need to be surrounded by people who love you.
Have to be.
And you have to realize you're not going to be the 100% of the person that you used to be. But you'll get there. It's going to take 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And obviously, now that you've shared that more in detail, because I know when we first met, you just kind of said my sister, you know, passed, but now hearing the actual experience of it and seeing, looking into your eyes, it's like, I feel your pain and I'm so sorry that happened to you, and to her and your whole family. How did things start to unfold from there for you?
So, there was a lot of like self-blame and guilt. You know, like I said, like I felt like I should have been there. I should have called her. So I did not know that she was addicted to painkillers until I cleaned up her apartment. Well, that's how, that was the cause of death, is overdose of Dilaudid. That was the, it's like things that they give to stage four cancer victims. And
why does she even have access to that? I know, so I didn't ask you the other day.
My sister was a musician, but she was also a nurse by trade. So,
oh, okay.
So she couldn't work in hospitals. You know, she's too much of an artist and very sensitive. So she did home care. And so home care, usually though, at that time, this was 2001, people were dying of AIDS and cancer. And she would give the medication, and they're usually painkillers when they're at home. It's the painkillers are there to ease their way into, you know, passing. And so she had access to this stuff, and technically you're supposed to dispose of them after. And there was an IV drip of a bag that was in her arm when she was found. So clearly it was leftover medication that she didn't dispose, and she took it home.
Wow.
And what I found in her medicine cabinet was she had painkillers that was prescribed for back pain that she had. Because my sister was tinier than me. I'm like 5'4". She was maybe 5'1".
You're so tiny.
Yeah. So can you imagine when you're a home care nurse, you have to change your patients. You have to flip them over. You have to change their beds. So she had to carry them. So she started having back pain because of that. Oh. And so here's the thing that sucks and is sad. Because I was CEO of a venture-backed company and I was making six figures, and I guess at the time she was making $45,000 as a nurse, I could afford to go out of pocket for alternative care and medication. When I had back pain, because I was an athlete growing up, I was a competitive cheerleader, I played like basketball, soccer, volleyball, softball, you name it, I've played it. I had some neck and back problems from bad falls and injury. So I went to a chiropractor who would adjust me regularly, and my headaches and my pain would go away. But it was like $150, $200 a pop. It wasn't covered by my health insurance. My health insurance, when I would go to a doctor, was like, here's prescription for painkillers. And I would look at that side effects of these painkillers. And the ones they were prescribing me at the time, when I looked it up, it was what they would give to arthritis patients. And it had all these things, like it would dry you out, your saliva, your vagina,
terrible
your entire
effects.
Body. Ugh. And there were all these side effects, and it would make you lethargic and low energy. I said, I can't take this if it's going to do all of this to me. Mm-hmm. And so I refused to do it. So I went to because I was an athlete. I knew physical therapists. I knew chiropractors were, you know, what they did for athletes. So I went to them, and I was able to go out of pocket, get adjusted, and my back pain would go away. My headache would go away. So she didn't. And when I sent her to the chiropractor, she said, I can't afford this. I just need to take the painkillers. And so what I didn't realize was that she got addicted to them, and years after, she was up to triple or more of the doses that she was taking. Because when they give you a painkiller, it masks the pain. It doesn't say that you need to stop carrying your bag on your right side and start carrying on the left, or stop. Maybe you should have a wheeled computer bag instead mm-hmm. of what you're putting on your shoulder, or maybe you should sit upright instead of hunching over. Like, or you need to do these stretches. This is what the chiropractor would tell me, the stretches and the ab workouts I need to do, so it's less pain on my back and more, you know, my abs can help support my body. All of those things is what physical therapists and chiropractors tell you. Whereas if you're in pain and you take a pill, you just don't feel it.
Yeah.
So it's still there. Yeah. And you're still carrying
you're
things the wrong
it.
Way.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just numbing it. So what happens is that injury becomes worse. So not only do you get addicted to the painkillers, you never heal the problem that you have. So you just get worse. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say this, it's part of the healthcare system. It is divided into the haves and the have-nots. And the fact that alternative medication is still not covered by insurance, it's mm-hmm. still something else that we have to pay out of pocket for. It's kind of sad.
It's sad.
But because the medical industry, healthcare industry, pharmaceutical industry doesn't make any money mm-hmm. from alternative care. It's just between you and your caregiver, and that's it. they don't want to provide insurance for it.
You know, it's great is actually I had a guest, he's awesome, Dane Johnson, and he and his mother are putting together a nonprofit supporting people in raising money for alternative care. And they have corporate sponsors to match whatever they raise. At least that's something, right? But exactly what you're saying, it's right now, it's there's no access. Or it's much more challenging to have access for most people.
And I hate that my sister was one of the statistics, early statistics in 2001. Now there's over 60,000, 65,000 deaths. I'm working with a political candidate, Andrew Yang, who's running for office. And I did research in New Hampshire, which was like one of his stops. And it's the number one issue now. But within 2 years, it flipped from the economy to drug abuse is the number one issue in New Hampshire. And it's a pretty well-off and intelligent population because they have universities there. And I was surprised to hear that. And out of 400 opioid deaths the year before, only one came from heroin. The rest was from prescription painkillers, which is crazy. And in various cities around the country, you see the same thing. It's no longer from illegal drugs. It's from legal drugs that people are abusing.
And a lot of that, too, is not to mask physical body pain. It's to mask emotional and mental pain, quite honestly. So that's really where a lot of the work has to be done is supporting people in, you know, healing emotionally and mentally and building that strength within. That's what I'm on the mission to do. So it's one at a time, you know, but...
Well, my sister started drinking and I think abusing painkillers, not just because of her back pain, but because she had a previous marriage who literally broke her heart, like it tore her apart. And she found out that the guy she married, who she thought was in love with her, actually only married her so he can get her green card. Oh. He was from Austria, and then all this time he had a side girlfriend that he wanted to bring over from the Czech Republic, and he finally brought her over, and one day they were having a New Year's party, and she was there, and this chick was all over her husband.
Whoa.
And, you know, she just wasn't the same person after that.
Of course.
You know, she stayed with me after that incident, and I would come home, and she would have gin bottles on the floor, and she'd be, like, wasted.
Yeah.
And no matter.
So she's been struggling for a while. Even
it was probably a couple of years. And which is probably why I always tried to be there for her and take her out and spend time with her and whatever free time I had. But because I had the startup, there was just very little free time. Mm-hmm. You're working, you know, 12, 14 hour days. And I just come home, like, just slept and exhausted.
So when you, after you learned of her passing, what was life for you? Or what was it like for you with your career? Because I know you shared a little bit, but I'd love for you to open up about how that all, like, what was there for you with your business?
Well, so what was tough about that time is also during the dot-com crash when all of a sudden all the naysayers that said Texas not going to succeed was this internet thing. It's never going to displace this, that, and the other thing. The adoption was slower than I was anticipated. Internet bandwidth was still not to where it was right now. A lot of buildings and houses and still had no broadband, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was, the experience was still very clunky in 2001. And so all of a sudden there was a crash in the market and investment and startups got pulled out. And those that received investment like me, I was supposed to get a follow-on round of $4 million that was committed by the VC I was working for, and that didn't happen because all the LPs from this VC started pulling out. So even the VCs themselves had no access to the cash that they were supposed to get. And it was a tough time. So imagine dealing with that, dealing with a startup that you had to depend, 26 people depended on you. My older brother was my director of operations, and he had three kids. So he was, you know, I employed my own brother. And the stress and pressure was so much, and to add the fact that, like, this happened. And I did not realize how much it would weaken me. It literally took air, blood, water out of my body. Like, that's how it felt. Like, I felt so deflated. So within 3 days of burying, like, we buried her within 3 days, and the next day I went to the office. I didn't take time off because how could I? I had to, like... continue to raise money. The VCs told me that if I found a another lead for the B round, that they would put in the $4 million. And so I continued to try to raise money, meet with VCs, everybody I could meet with, and possibly anyone. And even when I secured one, I was told like, "Oh, we still can't commit." It was like a runaround. Oh. You should have told me to begin with that you didn't have the money, because I would have then devoted all of that time in securing additional clients. Because mm-hmm. that's what I did. I mean, I bootstrapped the company for 2 years before I received investment. So because he was telling me that if I secured a lead investor, they would put in their $4 million that they committed to put in. And I went on for 6 months trying to secure that lead investor, and then for them to still say, "No, we can't." Mm. And that would have been 6 months of me knocking down the doors of every retailer, every, you know, big department store, every major brand, and you know, offer our services to build their e-commerce sites. Mm-hmm. And in hindsight, that's what I should have done instead of just depending on the VCs to give me the follow-on on investment.
Yeah.
So when I couldn't secure a follow-on investment, I was just like a shell of a person. And what people didn't see was that some days I couldn't get up out of bed. Some days I would get ready, get dressed, go as far as the subway, and then come back. And then I had speaking engagements, I had meetings, because some days I just didn't feel right. I just didn't feel myself, and I couldn't explain
it. Yeah, like the weight of the world on your shoulders on top of the grieving from your sister that you hadn't dealt with, right?
Right. So I forgot to mention was the organization that gave me that Women Business Owner of the Year, National Association of Business Owners. It's called NABO. They elected me to their board. And all, you know, I'm in my 20s, and all the women on that board were in their 40s and 50s and really were amazing CEOs. And so I went to the first board meeting. It was 2 weeks after my sister passed away. And I said to them, I said, "Thank you very much for inviting me to join your board. It's a real honor, but I don't think I could perform the duties of the board member because my sister just passed away, and I could barely handle what I have right now, let alone additional responsibilities that you might give me." And they were like shocked, these six women around this table, and said, "First of all, we're just so happy, or I mean, grateful that you came and share this with us in person. Really means a lot. And yes, we understand why you need to do what you need to do." And after we had this discussion and they gave me their support, I walked out of the meeting and went to the elevator, and this woman followed me out. And I wish I remembered her name, because she was so amazing. She had this beautiful blonde hair, and she was a top female executive at Fleet Bank. And she said, "Cecilia, I just want you to know I went through the same exact thing that you're just going through right now 2 years ago, where my sister, who is my best friend, also passed. And what really helped me was seeing this grief therapist." And that was the first time I heard of like such a thing as a grief therapist, that there's actually people there to help you get through this. And she said, "Here's her card. You might not think that you'll need it, but you will. Just hold on to it." And so October, November, December, January, February, March. Yeah, it was about over 6 months later, and I realized, I think I'm going insane. Like, I don't feel normal at all. Like, what's going on with me? I'm getting anxiety. I'm getting flaky. Sometimes I'm having a hard time getting to sleep. And then when I fall asleep, I'm having a hard time getting up. I didn't know all of these things were symptoms of depression. Mm-hmm. I was always like, you know, I was a cheerleader. I was bubbly and peppy. I was all this energy. And part of it is also internally, I felt shame that I wasn't there for her. Like, there was also this internal guilt that here I was having this life, amazing life. And I didn't know that she was still suffering. And that's when I say, like, people can have a facade of things are great. Mm-hmm. But you never really know what they're going through inside, you know?
Yeah. And I think what's challenging is we can get so caught up in our own lives that we don't necessarily really take the time to ask how someone's doing. Like, true, you know, there's a courtesy of, "How are you?" "Oh, I'm good. Good." And we all have masks pretending like we're okay. You don't know what's going on. But if we actually stopped and took a moment and said, "No, really, how are you?
and gave that person space to share. And some people might still be great, but I know that many times when I have done that, what I hear is that things are hard and they just really need some support. So, yeah.
And what was crazy was, I finally realized I need to shut down this business. Not only can I not raise money, I'm just really depleted and tapped out. Like, I can't go on. I just needed time off. Mm-hmm. And actually during the day that my sister was buried, her burial, we had a huge meeting with Macy's where over 13 executives from Macy's were coming to our office, and I was supposed to present to them. And it was supposed to be a multi-million dollar deal. This would have saved the business. And my president and co-founder at the time, Keisha Kobe, I said to Keisha, you're going to have to do this because I can't be there. And this was before Macy's did a roll-up where they rebranded over 12 different companies around the United States as Macy's. They were all had different names. And so all the executives from these different malls and department stores around the country flew in. Some from Florida, from Seattle, from West Coast, and I couldn't be there. So timing was also crazy. I don't know. So part of it was like, you know, things happen. Yeah. Things happen. So I by March or April, we were running out of cash, and I had to let go of people, and I had to shut it down, the business. And even though I had acquisition offers, the acquisition offers were like $1 million, $1.5 million. For a company that already raised $5 million, and they wanted me to work with them for at least 3 years.
Wow.
And I was at that point, I was like, the last thing I could think of was even having someone else depend on me to perform when I don't even know what I can deliver. I was so depleted and burned out, you know? So I had to pass on it, as I really can't, you know, if you want the clients, if you want my top employees, if I'll hand them off to you, but like, I can't come along with it.
Could not. Nope.
You know, and so what was interesting was my sister left these diaries and I read them, and in there she was talking about how badly she wanted to go to Jazz Fest, how badly she wanted to go to Burning Man, how badly she wanted to have a child, like all of these things that she manifested but never got to do. So I decided to go do them. I mean,
I love that.
And I felt like I had no choice but to do it. It was almost like she was compelling me to enjoy my life by doing the things that she always wanted to do.
But never actually took the time to. And now you know I got to take the time to go live because she didn't.
So I had this car for 4 years. I had less than 10,000 miles on it because I hardly took it anywhere. So I did a road trip to Jazz Fest with some friends. And we had an amazing time. And okay, you're going to think this is very weird. I'm going to go into a weird zone.
It takes a lot for me to think things are weird.
Okay, so for it. The day that she was buried, I remember getting dropped off by a car to my apartment. I took a nap, woke up, went to Tower Records. And so there were still Tower Records on Broadway. And all of a sudden, I spent over $300 on CDs. I was just randomly pulling CDs, mm-hmm. putting them in a bag. And I took them home. The following weekend, I had to clear out her apartment in Williamsburg. So in 2001, my sister had an apartment in Williamsburg, and it's in North Third and Kent, this warehouse building. I had to clear out her apartment. That was like one of the worst job in the world, I swear, is having to clear your dead sibling's apartment and decide what's to keep and what to throw out. I basically tossed out most things except for her favorite jackets and her CDs. One thing I realized as I was going through our CDs and packing them was that the CDs that I bought were from the artists that she had and collected. Whoa. But the CDs that I bought were not in her collection.
Shut up.
Yes.
Wow.
So like, for instance, she had tons of Prince CDs and I bought like the newest one or like some compilation that was
your
like-
Your sister, you guys are so connected. So, she was like- Yeah.
Ben Harper. I never heard of Ben Harper.
I love Ben Harper.
So, but I bought like Ben Harper's. So when I went to Jazz Fest with my friends, we're driving around. All of a sudden, I see on a marquee Ben Harper. I was like, holy shit, we got to go. So we had no tickets. We somehow, you know, got tickets.
Of course. Yep.
We all sat in different seats And we got to watch Ben Harper perform, and it was the most magical performance ever. And I felt overjoyed that my sister, through her CDs or through whatever,
she's been with you,
like, brought me to see Ben Harper in Jazz Fest in New Orleans and had the most amazing time.
Yeah. You know, I would love for you to share some of the stuff that you're talking with me about with working with that grief counselor. And because it's so powerful, but I know that you finally ended up going to see her, right? And then what were some of the things that she supported you in processing?
Yeah. So 6 months later, after she passed, Teresa passed, I still was feeling totally lost. And I remember going to this card and looking at it, and I said, I have no income right now. Like, I don't even know if I can afford who this is, but I should at least go. And I called her, first name is Anne, and her office was in the West Village. And I explained who recommended me, and she said, sure, come by. And I didn't know what to expect. And her office was actually in a home, not unlike this room that we're in right now, where it felt comfortable. It didn't feel clinical. It didn't feel like a medical office at all. It felt like someone's home. And she just starts asking me questions, you know, how are you feeling? What did you do today? Just conversational, basic things. I wasn't even sure what it was leading to. And it turned out all of those things I was experiencing, like anxiety, not waking up, canceling meetings, canceling speaking engagements, all those things. She made it sound like they were all normal. It's part of the grieving process. There's, you know, 7 steps of grief. Mm-hmm. And even like buying CDs that I don't know how I decided to buy those CDs. There was another story where I also started painting. My sister was a painter. And for some reason, I just went and got paints and started painting. And my friends were surprised because they never knew me to be a painter. And I was all fun and painting. And she said one of the things that the bereaved tend to do if they're close to the deceased is they take on they take on qualities and personalities of the deceased persons, the way that we hold on to them and not let them go. So there were all these unexplainable things that I would do where, I mean, I liked Prince, but I wasn't a fan, super fan like my sister. Mm-hmm. A Prince song that was obscure would come on the radio and I would know it word for word. And I swear I would have never heard that song before. Whoa. So things like this would happen. Anyway, that's the weird part of that whole time. I started going to the grief therapist, and I said to her, whatever, I want to go through this process, whatever it is, though, I don't want any painkillers. I don't want any medication. I don't want antidepressants. I don't want anything with a prescription, because mm-hmm. that's how my sister died. I did not trust the pharmaceutical industry. I didn't want to trust anybody that's going to write me a prescription and say it's going to make me feel better when I know it's
might kill me. Ask it again.
Yes.
You're like, I remember when I had shoulder pain and I read all the side effects. Yeah, don't want that either. Can you talk about really quickly the depression stuff, the way she described it?
So she goes, okay, well, this is how antidepressants work. If your normal level is this, and she holds up her two hands and my right hand and left hand side by side. And she said, and when you're depressed, your bottom is this. And she puts my right hand all the way down to like my knee and my left hand up to my face. What antidepressants do is keep your bottom from being that low and maybe make your bottom more like neck length, not knee length. So your recovery is easier. So that's how the medical industry explains it. So I said, so what can I do to do that naturally? And she said, well, the human body and human mind, we have the ability to create our own endorphins and dopamine. And these are natural hormones that just happen when you do things that you enjoy. So she said, just start doing things that you enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's proven that within 20 minutes of running or doing anything cardio, your dopamine goes up naturally. So she said, every day, do 30 minutes of cardio. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. And also take St. John's wort. St. John's wort improves your circulation. So it helps flush out all the bad chemicals and hormones that's trying to coat your brain to protect it. And she said, and also take flaxseed oil, because what it does is it lubricates your brain and it helps from that the bad hormones that are clinging to your brain and making you lethargic and depressed.
Because you said also when you said that depression actually coats your brain so that you can, so because it slows you down so that you actually deal with the trauma instead of keep being ongoing.
Yeah, so yeah. In a normal situation, when we all as human beings experience trauma, we're supposed to take a break. We're supposed to grieve. We're supposed to lie in bed and do nothing. It's traumatic. It's like we have to recover. But because we're all highly functioning people and we all have jobs and people who are dependent on us, we have to show up and be present. And we make ourselves show up and be present, but our minds and our bodies are just not there or don't, it shouldn't be there. So what these prescription medication does is it fakes us into feeling like we're okay when we're really not okay.
Not.
And I really, you know what? I really think it's abnormal for people also to expect us to be okay if we've gone through something traumatic and difficult like that. So I don't know how, you know, like for people who work, they only have X amount of sick days. For women, they only have, you know, 3 months maternity leave. There should be grief leave. I mean, some companies probably provide it, but it's really not covered. It's really not covered. And, it, you know, beyond sick days, when you're grieving, I don't know. They might give you an extra week or two, but I don't even think most people get that.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. And so fortunately for me, my accountant, while I was in the road trip to New Orleans for Jazz Fest, my accountant says, by the way, when are you coming by and picking up that check? And I said, what check? He's your tax return. Because my company was an LLC and we had losses, I was able to deduct my taxes. So all of a sudden I had $45,000 in cash.
Oh, hallelujah.
And so that was what I was able to use to allow myself to not take a job, not allow myself to be acquired and take on another job for 3 years and just go through the process. Because I don't know how I would have survived it if I didn't go through that process. And I wound up renting a beach house at LBI in the Jersey Shore away from people I knew and just stayed there for 5 weeks. Different friends came and stayed with me because they were worried about me being alone. My family would visit me. But I just really needed to just process the grief. If I needed to cry, I let myself cry. If I needed to feel her presence, just feel her presence. If I needed to be alone, because sometimes, you know, being alone is not bad, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes we need to be alone.
And I love how, you know, when you decided I'm not going to, you know, take any medications, what's the most natural way I can do this? And you also shared, you started slotting in deliberately the things that you love into your schedule.
Yeah. So if you're supposed to take antidepressants 3 times a day, I decided, okay, my first thing is 30 minutes of cardio. I'll wake up, go to the gym. And I started doing things that I enjoyed instead of having a pill. If I knew I was getting particularly sad that day and I know my favorite bands are in town, I would go see live music and dancing. Dancing was like my ultimate joy and like relief lever. So I would look at lineups. Fortunately, I lived only 2 blocks from Bowery Ballroom, and I would be at Bowery Ballroom almost every day.
Nice. How did you dance?
And then, you know what was weird? People thought I was like high or on drugs or something. No, it was just all natural because like I could literally feel the endorphins and dopamine replacing whatever depression things that was occupying my mind and feel immediately better. You know, if I needed to go for a walk, even if I'm in an office when I started working and I was feeling a little bit down, I'll go for a 30-minute walk in the sunshine. I'll go to the park. If there was a specific food that I loved, and even if I was working midtown, like I was craving these banh mi Vietnamese sandwiches, I will take the subway yeah. all the way down to Chinatown. If that sandwich gave me joy, I will have that sandwich, you know? Yes. So part of it was, and it was also my way of enjoying life, you know? And it was almost like, it helped me appreciate the simplest, littlest things. And so, yeah, to this day.
To give that to yourself too, because a lot of times we don't. We might want something where like, but what's easier and more convenient versus like, I want to go get what I want that's going to bring me joy. So many people settle or we just take, you know, good enough. But what if we actually gave ourselves what we really desired? That's just what's coming up for me.
I mean, right now, so yeah, so that. The self-love aspect of it is needed. We need to take care of ourselves. And it's weird that I needed to go to a grief therapist for her to say that to me, that I needed to give myself my own pills. My own body has the ability to release the dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, all of those things that these pills give you. You have the ability to generate that yourself with your own experiences.
What are some other ways that you tapped into that serotonin for yourself? And I don't know if it was just merely, hey, I'm going to make sure that I do the things that bring me joy, but were there other practices, tools, or mindsets that you had to also support you through this time?
Well, you know what? You know, it's crazy. So one of those things also is like cuddling and making love is a natural thing. But I also knew that I was in a needy situation. So I would actually give disclaimers to people I would have a relationship with. I would say, by the way, I'm going through grief right now. And yes, this feels great, but I'm not really in a position to be close emotionally with anyone. I was aware of it. Like, I wanted to let them know that this was not like bigger than what it was. And I also knew it was medication for me, you know? Because I knew I was in a process of healing. I totally get when people go through those 12-step processes and they say not to have a relationship with someone because when you all of a sudden feel good because someone's hugging you or making love to you, it becomes your drug.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, there's a bonding. The oxytocin starts flowing, and then you're bonding with this person, especially for females.
Right. And if you're totally depleted of that, and all of a sudden you're displacing your healing on someone else that may not even be right for you. So I was cognizant of that. And did not want to go in that direction. But the interesting thing is, so I rented this beach house. I was there alone. I did meet someone, you know, at this place who was visiting his aunt and had a fling with him. And oddly enough, 2 weeks after 9/11, I found out I was pregnant, which is a crazy time. No, I'm unemployed. My apartment in Soho, I had sublet, so I was able to take time off and not have the financial pressure. And I had just moved in, back in, and my $45,000 of tax refund was depleting. And I was like, whoa, I'm pregnant. What should I do with this? And all I can remember was in my sister's diary over and over again, she said how much she wanted to have a child, how badly she wanted to have a child. And at this point, I realized, like, this is a gift. This is not a bad thing. I can do this. So the other story is my younger brother got his girlfriend pregnant and they were both 17. So I have a nephew that was now who they raised. They wind up getting married later on, like I think after my nephew turned 4, and continued our lives together. She continued college. He continued college and has an amazing career. And they have had 2 more kids since. So I was like, if my brother and my sister-in-law can do this at 17,
you can do it, yeah.
With no career and yet, and they were still in school. I said, I can do this. I was CEO. Like, I can do this. I can get a job, you know? Uh-huh. So all those negative things where people say, oh my God, you can do this by yourself. People have done worse things on their own, you know? Mm-hmm. So I felt really supported. I told my parents at Thanksgiving, I said, Mom, Dad, I want to let you know I'm pregnant. And my mother said, well, are you planning to keep it? And I said, yes. And she said, your dad and I love you very much and we'll do everything we can to support you.
So good.
And as soon as I heard that, everything just fell into place. I sent an email to some of my best friends. And I said, I'm going to need a birthing coach who goes to go to these classes with me. And you actually have to be in the delivery room with me.
So anybody who doesn't like blood, oh, yes. You cannot come in, but whoever can.
So my friend Jennifer Johnson said, I'll do it. Oh, like, that's so she amazing. Became my Lamaze coach. Everybody thought we were lesbians. They thought, you know, we would go into these classes and it was like male, female couples. And she was there. I just so many people just rallied and around me and gave me so much love to the point where when I delivered Mateo at NYU Hospital, I had a waiting room of people. I had friends who came in from Maine, from gave up their weekends because it was Memorial Day weekend when it happened, in the Hamptons, who were like in the mountains somewhere, and they all heard that I was in labor, and they all came. And so every day I had tons of visitors, I had flowers, and the people at NYU Hospital said, you're a celebrity or something? We never had someone get so many guests and gifts here before, as much as you do. It was crazy. I mean,
it just goes to show the impact that you'd already made on a lot of people's lives.
But part of it too is I realize it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to seek help because people actually want to help you. People actually want to show up for you mm-hmm. if you let them. You don't have to be superwoman and do everything yourself. It's okay to seek help. It's okay to ask for it. And it's okay to say, oh, and at the time during my pregnancy, I was also anemic. So I wound up fainting at like the Chase Manhattan Bank in Soho. And I had to take like 2 horse pills a day just to keep my iron levels up.
Wow.
And so I was also, as an independent woman, I had to acknowledge that I need someone else to take care of me as a single parent. So that's when I sublet my apartment. I moved in with my parents and allowed them to take care of me. My parents hadn't taken care of me since I left for college. So I also gave them, you know, opportunity to show me. They love, and my dad was just retired. So my dad was making me smoothies and taking
Ooh,
care of me.
Nice.
So it was nice to sort of have that and be supported and loved.
Yeah. And I know you shared that Mateo became your purpose and he was a catalyst for you to let go of, you know, what you needed to move forward.
All of a sudden, I have this like mouth to feed. Who's 100% dependent on me. And so I hustled and got a job. You know, I sent an email to friends and said, okay, I'm done with my maternity leave. I'm ready to go to work now. So I was given a job as VP of strategy at a tech firm. And after that, I was hired by Burberry to run their e-commerce. And then after that, I was recruited by La Perla to run their e-commerce globally. So just things just fell into place. And I wound up taking more corporate work because I needed stability now that I have a mouth to feed. Mm-hmm. And didn't do the startup thing until he was past 10 or 12. Mm-hmm. And he's almost 16 now.
Amazing.
He's going to be 16 soon.
Are there any other things that you do right now? Because knowing that how important self-care is and all the lessons that you learned from that time, are there any things that you currently do to continue to support yourself?
So I do yoga almost every day. I feel like I need that meditation and centeredness. It really does reset my brain. So some mornings I still miss my sister, and some mornings I don't feel that good. And some mornings I still feel the pain of failure. And some mornings I feel, you know, the loss of other relationships. Things happen in our lives, and certain days they hit us differently. I mean, I lost my father last year around Christmas time. So you know, so every day has its different challenge. And yes, we still have to show up and turn up. And so I feel like yoga every morning helps me do that. I also don't drink very little. Like I have a 1-drink maximum thing. And so sometimes, and if I drink, I only drink it with food. I can't do an empty stomach just because it makes me feel lousy. I'm one of those, like my Asian genes.
Me too. I'm allergic to it. I literally can't breathe if I have more than maybe 4 sips. So I just don't.
I actually get my hangover right away. So it's not even fun for me. Drinking for me, it's like not fun at all. Within 15 minutes of the drink, I have a hangover. So I just don't. But it's a good thing. So part of it is listen to your body. You know, I know it's not good for me, so I just don't do it. Because of I wake up 6:30 every day. I make him breakfast every day. I want to be there for him to help him get ready for school. I might not be there for dinner every day, but I'm there for breakfast every day. Make sure like he feels good. And I mean, when you have a child at home and you have to be up every day at 6:30 to feed them, they're dependent on you. And, you know, lately he's like, can you sew this thing on my pants or my button came off or all of that? You can't be doing that hungover.
You can't. Not as fun.
You know? So yeah, I mean, I want to be present for him. Yeah. And so, so taking care of me and taking care of him is the same thing.
Yeah. So good. Oh, Cecilia, thank you so much for being so authentic, so raw, and so open. I think the world needs a lot more of you. You know, people like you who are willing to share, you know, that things aren't always easy, but there are always pathways up and out. So thank you so much. I've got a few questions for you to close this out.
Okay.
The first is, what's something unique about you that most people don't know?
That's odd. Unique about me that most people don't know. I can still do cartwheels and backflips.
You can?
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Well, because of yoga, I guess, you know, you keep your muscle tone, you keep your flexibility. What's the other thing is, I'm such a flawed person. And part of it is we have to recognize that what our flaws are, and we have to also recognize that because we're not perfect, other people aren't perfect. I feel like everybody out there is waiting for the perfect person, and I don't think that person exists.
No.
There's always trade-offs. So I'm in general an optimist, but I guess I'm also a realist. Mm-hmm.
And when you're in a really dark place, what's your go-to to get out?
Music. Also planning trips. I love to travel. So, you know, it's proven though that you get more endorphins from planning trips than the actual trip itself.
Really?
Yeah. Just projecting and envisioning the opportunity and the chance of that magical trip.
I love traveling, but I don't plan that much anymore because I used to be such a planner before, and now I just want to flow and see what happens. But knowing that it's in the calendar that I'm
even knowing it's in the calendar, just knowing that you have that to look forward to. Mm-hmm. So today, actually, I'm heading to Tangier, Morocco for the first time. I was invited to speak at a conference, and I have a friend that moved there 2 years ago. So he wants to show me around. He and his wife just moved there. So I'm looking forward to that. I always put something in my schedule to look forward to.
I should ask you to bring back some poofs for me.
Sure. What are poofs?
Those Moroccan poofs.
Those Moroccan poofs.
I love the Moroccan style and vibe. So I'm just fixing up my room to make it even more Moroccan-y.
Nice.
And knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self?
Wow. My 10-year-old self. For some reason, I don't remember being a very happy child. Like, I remember, like, taking my dog in the laundry room and like crying sometimes. And I don't know why. Like, so my 10-year-old self, not to take everything so seriously and to heart, like, and not to feel like you're the only one going through difficulty. Everybody goes through difficulty. Everybody goes to a tough time. And it's just a matter of how you can overcome that and get past it. And for when I see and hear about people who are depressed and commit suicide, believe me, I've thought about it once or twice. And one time I said, I could never allow Mateo to believe that I didn't love him enough to stay for him. So when I think about the things that day, I was like, oh my God, these problems are so enormous. And, you know, it was related to like a startup failing and, you know, having to face people about your failure, having to tell investors that you've let them down, having to tell like all these people. So anyway, but part of it is like, that's nothing. People go through failure all the time. You can surpass it. Your business and that life and that identity is not what defines you. Mm-hmm. And I feel that, you know, the suicide and ending your life or whatever is a cop-out. You're better off just traveling somewhere else. And like what I did was regenerate and rethink your life and understand who your real friends are. During that time, when I took time off and my business failed, it was the friends who visited me who are still my dear friends right now, who drove 3 or 4 hours to visit me. It's those friends who were there for me in the hospital room and visited me. And they're still friends to this day that I can call on at any time and they'll be there for me. So those are the ones that you need to treasure and really value. Mm. So yeah, I mean, just surround yourself with people who love you, who are authentic.
Absolutely. And you do that when you show up in that way too, because you wouldn't have those incredible people around you, Cecilia, if you didn't show up that way as well. And even just hearing you say at the start of the show, when you're going, when it's people's birthdays, I want to make them feel so good. It's because you care. And it's that level of joy that you want others to experience by making them feel so special is why they want to do that back for you. Because you're the source of everything. So everything that you have in your life is a reflection of who you are. And that's why that is. And I'm so, again, grateful for you, grateful of how all this came together, that you were my first Habitas homie, and that you were open and willing enough to just jump in with me a couple days later to record this. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I think what you're doing, your purpose is magical. And if you're planning on affecting lives, and I'm all for your mission, and wish you much luck and success in everything that you're doing.
Thank you. Love you, sister.
Love you too.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I mean, this one, it really touched me so deeply. And I was grateful to be sitting across from Cecilia as we recorded, because I was able to see and feel her pain and also feel her love and the healing from her loss. And I'm really thankful for how truthful Cecilia was too. I mean, death can be so painful and beautiful all at the same time, and it's inevitable. And so it's really good to have pathways for healing, and I hope what Cecilia shared can support you if you're moving through a time of grief right now, or when that time comes in the future. And you know, even if you're struggling with depression and not from a loss, but just going through it, I'd really encourage you to seek support. And if you can infuse self-care to lift your spirits, even if it's just a little bit, please do that for yourself. All right, so to close this out, if there's someone that you know who could benefit from this episode, pretty please share it with them. And if you got value from this episode and you want more, make sure you subscribe to the podcast. And I would be so grateful if it feels aligned for you to leave me a 5-star review on iTunes, because that means we can support even more people to rise higher together. And as always, I've got a free gift for you if you haven't already downloaded it. It's my free self-love kickstart, and it's got some powerful practices to support you in owning your worth, rocking your confidence, and opening up to your own love to radically transform your life. Because, you know, I really believe that self-love is the key to everlasting happiness, unconditional love, and it's also a pathway to healing and to having anything and everything that you want. So if you want that, then make sure you go and download my free self-love kickstart that I created just for you at stephaniekwong.com/self-love-kickstart. All right. So for everything that we mentioned in today's episode and for links to connect with Cecilia, you can check it out in the show notes over at stephaniekwong.com/EP23. And of course, you can check out all my other podcast episodes there too. Okay, guys, until next time, I'm sending you so much love.